You are here for the NEPA and Mining 101 webinar. This is part one of a three-part series that will look at mining fundamentals. This course is designed to provide an overview of mining in NEPA, and it's geared towards how tribes can participate in the NEPA process. Part one will educate participants on the major steps in mine development, exploration, types of hard rock mining, and mineral processing. Your presenters will provide an engaging look into the world of hard rock mining, and participants will walk away with a basic understanding of the types of mining and gain a common language to communicate about mining in their geographic area of interest. And we are encouraging you to share questions and comments as well as to respond to that poll. Thank you to those of you who have already voted and let us know who's joining from your particular location. We're going to be joined by three instructors today. Our first instructor will be Cindy Godsey, who's joining us from EPA Region 10. She was born and raised in Michigan, and she has earned a Bachelor of Science in Mining Engineering from Michigan Technological University and a Master of Business Administration from Northern Kentucky University. She worked in the mining industry for 6 years before joining us here at EPA, where in the last 25 years, she's worked on NPDES permits and compliance. And she also lived in Alaska for 19 years, working primarily on mining permits. And then back in 2014, she relocated to EPA's Seattle office, where she is the senior NPDES permit writer in Region 10 and has been a member of the national, or pardon me, the regional mining team since its inception in 1995. Lorraine Edmond will also be joining us from EPA Region 10. She grew up in Oklahoma before going to Colorado College for her bachelor's degree and to the University of Montana for a master's degree, both in geology. She did mineral exploration for 10 years and also finished up with 6 years of exploration camps and drilling camps in many remote locations in Alaska. Since 1989, she has worked in EPA Region 10's Office of Environmental Assessment in Seattle, where her work there includes providing technical support to multiple programs, including Superfund, EIS review, and other water and groundwater-related projects. And then our third instructor will be Patty McGrath from Donlin Gold, LLC. Patty has 30 years of mining experience, including 7 years as a metallurgical engineer. And at the beginning of her career, she also has 23 years of environmental regulation, 19 years with EPA, and 4 years in the consulting industry. She has expertise in the application of the NEPA, or National Environmental Policy Act, Clean Water Act, and federal consultation laws. I think in the interest of time, we'll go ahead and take a real quick look at some of those responses that have come in from the live audience, just to kind of get a general sense of who's joining us today. It does look like about a third of our audience comes from the federal government, about 10% are state regulators, 15% are tribal affiliated participants. About 28% of you are coming from the private sector, and then we have a mixture of other participants, including some site owners. So thank you very much for sharing those affiliations. On a good note, well over three-quarters of the audience have been to a mine site already, so you at least have some boots-on-the-ground experience. 14% of you have at least either been involved with the mine project, but perhaps not actually visited the site, and then just under 8% have done neither of those. And we have a nice distribution of participants coming in from all over the country, but it does look like the western half of the country is where we're seeing our greatest level of participation. So I think with that overview, let me go ahead to your first instructor today, call up those presentation materials, and let Cindy Godsey take over. Cindy, whenever you're ready.
Thanks, Jean, and thanks to everybody who's participating today, and we hope that you'll find our session informative. Oh, wait a second. We're on slide 40.
We are correcting that right now.
Thank you. We'd get done really quick if we did that. Okay, so Mining Fundamentals is the first of a three-part series of webinars that encompasses our NEPA and Mining 101 training, and these webinars will, other webinars will occur over the next couple weeks, the second on May 24th and the last on June 8th. So if you haven't registered for those, do so at the CLUIN website. So today we'll talk about some mining in the U.S. and where the U.S. stands in some of the metals markets globally. And we'll talk about the mining development process. And we'll include some descriptions of the fundamentals listed here. We'll talk about exploration, different types of mining and mineral processing, and the ultimate disposal of mining waste products. Okay, in the next few slides, we'll see how the U.S. ranks globally in some metals markets. And this first slide shows major gold-producing countries, and you'll see those in the dark gray shaded areas. And in 2014, the U.S. ranked fourth. China ranked first. And large gold mines can be found in Nevada, Colorado, and Alaska. And there's a new mine under construction in South Carolina, and it's bigger than any gold mine that's ever been seen there before. And some gold copper potential in Alaska, Idaho, and Montana, Minnesota, and Wisconsin could be future mines if the markets are right and the climate is right for it. And 70% of all of U.S. large mine facilities are gold and or copper mines. So this shows the major copper producing countries, and the U.S. ranked sixth in 2014, and Chile was first. And some of the copper producing states, Arizona, New Mexico, Utah, Nevada, Montana, and Michigan. As we said, there's some new potentials going on in some of the states. And copper is used mainly in construction and electrical equipment. So commodity prices have an effect on the exploration. Jean, could you turn on the pointer, please? Thank you. And you can imagine that more resources would be put into exploration when a commodity is on the upswing than on the downturn. And commodity prices also have an effect on what gets extracted from the ground and what remains behind, and we'll talk about that in some future slides. This shows the major silver producing countries, and in 2014, the U.S. ranked ninth, and Peru was first. Silver is mined in Alaska, Arizona, Utah, and Nevada, and a lot of other states. It's generally mined with other metals such as lead, zinc, and gold. And silver is used in electronics and energy, everything from cell phones to solar panels, and solar mainly because of its reflectivity. This slide is an older slide, and it shows some uranium deposits around the country. In 2014, the U.S. ranked ninth globally, and Kazakhstan was first. In 2015, the U.S. Produced 3.3 million pounds of uranium from one mill in Utah and several in-situ mining operations in Wyoming, Texas, and Nebraska. And this 3.3 million pounds accounted for 9% of the uranium used by nuclear power plants. The remaining 91%, or around 33 million pounds, was imported. And the uranium reserve estimates are strongly sensitive to price. And with the price now hovering around $30 per pound, some of those reserves that you saw on the previous slide would be less viable than they were a couple years ago when the price was around $60 a pound. Alaska leads the country in lead and zinc mining, and lead is mined in Missouri and zinc in Tennessee. Phosphate mining occurs in Florida and in Idaho, and iron ore mines are found in Minnesota and Michigan. Molybdenum mining happens in Arizona, Colorado, and in Idaho. And this map shows metal mines around the state, and as you can see by the legend, there's a lot more listing of metals than we've discussed in the previous slides. Jean, could I have the pointer again, please? And you can leave it on for the next few slides. Thank you. Okay, so this shows coal deposits around the country, and in Appalachia, there's a lot of underground coal mining, and through Texas and the western states, there are a lot of large open pit or strip mines, and there is a coal mine in Alaska. So there's several major steps in mine development and probably a million more smaller ones. And even though the days of a prospector out there in Dunbar Hills with his pickaxe and mule are long gone, prospecting is still a necessary first step. Technology's made this easier with geologic data and maps available online. And finding a potential site, whether virtually or physically, is followed by staking a claim or get exclusive access to the site. And exploration will ultimately determine the extent of the mineralization on the property. The rubber meets the road with the feasibility study, which will make or break a project. And if the results are good, the project may move forward to evaluation and permitting and then to construction. But even if a project, even a good project could be backburnered depending on a company's priorities and funding decisions. When a mine starts, there's usually a set mine life, but it's usually becomes longer with continuing exploration. For example, the Greens Creek mine in southeast Alaska has had a 10-year mine life since it opened in 1989. After operations, shutdown occurs, and this entails the removal of buildings and equipment that are no longer necessary on the site. And generally, some form of concurrent monitoring occurs throughout the mine life, but after closure, reclamation continues and becomes a major activity. Recontouring and revegetation occur, preparing the site to the final specifications of the land manager or owner. And these pictures here on the slide show before and after reclamation at the Palmerton Zinc Smelter in Pennsylvania. So long-term monitoring and maintenance continue for many years, with some mines having to consider water management strategies in perpetuity. And each of these steps will be elaborated on, some more than others, through the presentation. So this is a typical time frame for a mine. Some of these phases overlap a little more than others than shown here. And of course, it's always dependent on the project. But the general, let's see if I can grab that. There it is. So the general scheme is that initial exploration will lead to advanced exploration. Information from the exploration and the environmental studies will lead to pre-feasibility. More information then leads to feasibility, NEPA, and permitting. Once financing is assured, then construction can commence. So that's the end of our opening. And so, Jean, are there any questions on this section before I turn it over to Lorraine?
Yeah, we did have two questions that came in. I just want to remind the audience, you can submit your questions and comments using the Q&A window in the lower right corner of your screen. We did have one question, and I think you just hit on it in that previous slide, asking exactly what regulations apply to starting a mine. Do they have to get a permit as a landowner before they start to develop it? And I think your timeline just provided an excellent illustration that there are some permits that are required. Did you want to expand on that concept any further?
Well, I think that, I mean, for the very beginning, Lorraine will talk a little bit about some of the permits that are necessary for exploration. And then we don't really touch on it further, but there are a plethora of permits that are necessary for a mine to go into production. So it can include, you know, land use permits, wetlands dredge and fill permits, NPDES discharge permits, down to, you know, permits that you have to get from a health agency to run the cafeteria on the site. So there's a lot of different ones that have to be gotten.
Excellent. And I also received a note from the organizers just reminding us that this is a multi-part series in terms of the webinar. So part three of the webinar series will actually go into regulatory details and looking at the regulatory process. So for those of you that have lots of questions about the regulatory process in mind, make sure you sign up for part three in the webinar series. We'll talk more about that before we close out today. I do have two additional comments that came in, and so I'm just going to read off this first one that references a permit. One of our attendees mentioned that many uranium mines remain permitted but spend more time on standby than on an actual period of operation. And so she just mentions that in her experience, standby is a major part of the lifetime of the mine. And I don't know if you can comment on that, Cindy, in your experience.
Well, I haven't dealt with a lot of uranium mines, but I know that we have had mines on standby over the years. One that I know of and one that their NPDES permit did anticipate that there could be standby periods when, after a certain length of time, the frequency of monitoring would decrease if production wasn't occurring. So I don't think it's as common in other with other commodities as it might be with uranium.
Okay. And then we had another comment that got into prices. One of our attendees mentioned that market prices for uranium are number one, spot market $27.60, and two, long-term market $44. They commented that long-term market prices are a better indicator of your uranium mining economics. And I don't know if you can comment or expand on that concept.
No, it was, I mean, I just pulled the spot prices off for last month and for a couple years ago just to do a quick comparison on, you know, what the reserves might be and how they differed at different prices. So, and it's probably true, as in all commodities, that a long-term average is probably a better indicator than a spot price.
All right, excellent. Thank you. I don't see any other online questions or comments in the queue, but again, participants, you can send them in at any time. If you have follow-on questions that relate to this segment, we'll certainly have time later on to get back to them. So I'm going to go ahead and suggest that we carry on with the next portion of the presentation, and I believe Lorraine Edmonds, you're carrying on with the talk.
Yes. Next, we're going to talk about actually the first step in the whole process, which is the prospecting and exploration phase. We'll talk mostly about the steps, what those involve, and a little bit about the legal aspects of that. So in the U.S., lands that are open to mining are, that's sort of the default, you might say. All the federal lands that are not specifically withdrawn from entry under the mining law are open to mining. And these include the national forest, which sometimes surprises people. But specific types of lands that are closed include these listed, Bureau of Reclamation, conservation areas, national monuments and national parks, as you might expect, wildlife refuges, wild and scenic rivers within a quarter mile of the bank. If you're not on federal land and you're on state land, there are similar laws, somewhat parallel, but always state by state variables, of course. So the laws and the regulations that that describe what how this process works actually date back to the 1872 mining law for federal lands. And the states, of course, have their varied dates. But these are the 1872 mining law essentially codified what had been an informal system developed by prospectors in California and Nevada during the Wild West and the Gold Rush days. And it sort of organized that, and it hasn't actually changed since then. The first step is that the claims have to be self-initiated. That can be by a person or by a company. They have to be staked. In order to be valid, they have to be considered a discovery of a valuable deposit, which is a little bit soft, a term that's not, it's not really well defined in the law. Some of the legal tests that have been used have to do with whether a reasonable person would expend money working that claim and whether the minerals can be currently marketed at a profit. So what this basically means is you can't just go into a national forest and say, you know, this little area has a nice view and I think I'll stake a claim so I can build a cabin. You can't do that. There has to be some indication that there's actually a, quote, valuable deposit. There are several different types of minerals, three different classes, actually. The ones that the claiming process applied to are called locatable minerals, and these include what you often think of, you know, platinum, gold, silver, copper, lead, zinc, and uranium are in that category. The next category is called leasable minerals, and these go through a competitive bidding process. And the specific partial list of those is petroleum, coal, phosphate, sodium, and potassium. And there's a third category that's called saleable, which is things like sand and gravel, which are in yet a different category. So a claim has to be staked, which means marked on the ground and registered. And then to hold on to a claim, you have to pay a fee or do assessment work. You file the notice with the land management agency and you pay a fee based on the number of claims that you have. And if it's on state land, those laws are somewhat variable. Another aspect of the 1872 mining laws has to do with royalties during production. If it becomes a mine, there are no royalties required on federal land. States have varying requirements from none up to 10% of the net income. Patenting is an interesting process that's sort of historic, I guess you could say, and it's a way to convert federal land to private land. There's currently a moratorium on new patenting, but in older mining districts, there's lots of patented claims. Sometimes they're totally surrounded by federal land, such as there'll be a little gap in the middle of the national forest of private land that's patented mining claims from the olden days. And after those claims have been patented, that is then private land that can be bought and sold and put to any legal use. So it doesn't have to be a mine anymore. This is a list, a partial list of the exploration activities. Not all of these will happen on all projects. It's sort of a general order and it's not literal. At the early stages, you'll notice there's some less invasive activities such as mapping and some geochemical sampling and staking the claim. The further the process goes down from these early stages down here, once you get into trenching and drilling and bulk sampling, you're starting to see ground disturbance. So those may have different permitting requirements. And it's also important to note that the projects only move along this path if each stage of results is encouraging, that it continues to indicate that something potentially valuable is there. Otherwise, there's no, you know, inclination to keep spending money. They get more expensive as you go farther down the list, too. And another thing I wanted to remember to point out was that although all mines start out as exploration projects, there's actually few exploration projects that end up as mines. It's just, there's a lot of attrition along each of these steps along the way. So exploration is defined as the activity that is spent searching for those mineral deposits. And as we've said before, they usually have little ground disturbance. As the project becomes more successful, there's more disturbance. Road building, if you have to drill in an area where there's no access, there'll be road building. Trenching is obviously disturbing of the surface. The type of permits required for exploration depend, again, on what type of land you're on. For federal permits, as Cindy said, depending on what you're doing, you may have to get a Clean Water Act 404 general permit or an individual permit for wetlands disturbance. And on federal land, you do have to get approval by the land management agency, whether that's U.S. Forest Service or the Bureau of Land Management. State permits vary by state, typically some sort of land use permit, and you may need a temporary water use permit. Sometimes you have water use for a camp, say, or for a drilling project. This is an example of sediment sampling. Sediment sampling is an important component of exploration because if you think about an ore body, you know, often they're not exposed at the surface at all, but even if they are, it's probably going to be a really tiny area. So there will be an area around that that's enriched in specific elements that can be used as geochemical tracers. And a stream sediment sample will erode the land and sort of give you a larger sample of the subsurface. It represents the geochemistry of a much larger area than just a little individual sample of a rock on the earth. In this photo, the sampler is using a gold pan to concentrate heavy minerals for analysis. And that's for certain types of deposits, that would be what you'd want to do if you wanted to actually look for gold nuggets, or sometimes you'd be looking for just heavy magnetic minerals associated with sometimes the deposits. For other types of deposits, you might look for finer sediments that are just particularly effective at concentrating metals from the water that passes over them. So the type of sampling is going to depend on what you think you're looking for. This is an example of a geophysical survey, a helicopter-borne, I think that's a magnetometer. It would be flown in a grid over the land, and that's the difference in the magnetic response to the rocks below. So as you imagine, you can cover a lot more ground a lot quicker with this sort of technology, but obviously it's much more expensive. The result, you get a map like the one shown there in the upper corner, and these hotter colors, darker colors, would indicate areas where there was a larger response. This would be sort of the background. You know, there'd be acres and acres that look like this, and then you have these what we call anomalies that would warrant further investigation, perhaps through other methods. So maybe you have a magnetic anomaly or some other type of geophysical anomaly, and you decide to take the next step, which might be soil sampling grid. This is a really detailed soil sampling grid. This is not just early exploration days. These holes are quite close together. You can see the size plotted indicates the results that they found. And at this point, you'd be targeting certain areas for further work. Probably drilling would be your next option. At this point, you say, we know what's on the surface, but we don't know what's underneath. As you all know, that most of the land surface is covered by soil, not rock, but there are geochemical indicators in that soil as the rock weathers. So the next step, in a way to spend a lot more money a lot faster, is core drilling. You might do rotary drilling. This is an example of core drilling, and this looks like it's in Alaska. So this is a drill rig, a pretty small one that was brought in by a helicopter. And there was, you know, a very specific reason based on all this previous success from all those previous steps that indicated that information was needed from this location. And the person in the upper right is logging the core. And what that means is this is your one chance sort of to see, literally see with your eyes what's below the surface. So she is making notes of every visible aspect of that core that you can imagine, the color and the alteration and the veins and the structure in it and what kind of condition it's in. And then specific intervals of interest that seem promising for mineralogy would be split in half to obtain samples that would be sent to the laboratory for the chemical analysis. So the core drilling is a way to not only determine the grade of the mineral deposit at that precise location, but a collection of many, many drill holes would be used to define the geometry and the mineralogy of the ore deposit, which would help determine the most appropriate mining method and the mine design.
That's that. Oh. There's no transition slide.
Oh,
it must have gotten moved.
Well, are there questions at this point? Jean?
Yes, there are. I think I have a number of comments that have come in, and I'm going to read off one that a number of participants have made, and this was just more of a clarification or correction. Several people just chimed in with a note that the fees for mining claim filings are actually different than what were displayed or discussed on the slides. Some of the participants have gone so far as to let us know that they're currently $155 per load. And some are even sending the links of where you can find that scheduled information. So I'm not sure if you guys have seen these updated fees or any comments on that.
Well, we can update that slide for the next presentation. Honestly, I haven't been associated with that aspect in a really long time, but once you get involved in an exploration project and start going through these steps, you're going to find out really specifically what the requirements are for your specific location and what agency you're dealing with. How much everything costs.
Excellent. We did have another participant who commented that, and they just said that most but not all refuges are closed. And I don't know if you can expand on that idea or that thought, if you had encountered that yourself.
I don't know. Cindy has something to say on that.
Well, and it's not only refuges, but national monuments and national parks. In like Lorraine talked about in holdings and claims, you know, some of the parks like in Alaska, you new land got added to it in the early 80s, and some valid mining claims were on those lands that got added to parks and preserves, and as long as those claims were kept up,
they were
kind of grandfathered in. So There are some facilities that have moved forward in developing different kinds of mining in parks and preserves, and I don't know of any in refuges, but I'm sure that the same holds for that. And the Greens Creek mine that I mentioned in Southeast Alaska is within, parts of it are within a national monument.
Yeah,
and I think that national monument might have happened in the 80s, and exploration had already advanced on Greens Creek a lot, so they might have grandfathered it in because of that.
That's a really good point, though, is that all those categories of lands, well, all of our categories of lands are legal definitions, and they're always subject to change. They can be expanded or shrunk in some cases, I guess. So as boundaries change, yeah, all bets are off, but you would always know when you're working on a prospect in a particular place. You know,
right.
The,
I mean,
the land ownership is kind of like the first thing you'd want to know about.
Right, and the land manager or the owner should be basically the first place. I mean, permission to be where you want to mine is probably the first thing that you should figure out. And you know, if the park or refuge is willing to work with you and finds that it's allowable, then you can move forward through the process.
Okay. We did have another question that just sort of chimed in as you guys were responding. This participant wanted to know, what about Indian reservations withdrawn? And they clarified is that they're talking about withdrawn from exploration via the BLM.
Well, that is likely an individual tribe's decision on how they want to manage their lands.
Yeah, I would think you would have to work with the tribal government to make those determinations, because some reservations will have their own environmental laws, their own mining laws.
And some have environmental programs, in air or water quality and things like that. So for reservations, it's definitely a land management decision by the tribes themselves. And of course,
it's
they
equivalent to being in a different state or another state. Very
well, and the federal agencies work with them on those things because of the government-to-government relationship that the federal government has with the tribes. But it's not anything that the federal government decides. It's the tribes themselves that decide it.
We did have a question that came in just looking for some history or clarification. This attendee asks, why are minerals separated into locatable and leasable? What exactly is the history on this?
I don't have the slightest idea, but it's an interesting question. I sort of wondered that, too, when I came across it. Do you know, Patty?
I don't know, but I imagine if there's a question we can't answer, we could find the answer and email the participant back if need be. I don't have the history on that either.
Yeah, I don't have the history on that either, but, I've always heard about these leasing, especially, oil and gas leases, but that was the only thing I was familiar with before that, and I never really looked at oil and gas as part of 1872, so...
We did have one participant who chimed in. I think that they're familiar with this concept, and they said,
oh, good.
In and of itself, that would be a whole day webinar topic. It may not be something we can answer, so thank you for sharing that background. I have had a couple of additional questions and comments come in. I think if it's okay, we'll go ahead and take those now. We have some time, because it looks like we've got some good discussion chiming in here. We did have people just comment in confirming what you were mentioning in terms of working on tribal reservations, that most of those reservations have their jurisdiction over mineral exploration and extraction on their lands. And so some tribes will work with the BLM to administer and select the mineral programs, and it's exactly as you all have discussed. So we're just getting confirmation that you have summarized that accurately. We did have somebody mention that CWA Section 404 permits are required for discharges into waters of the U.S., which include streams, and it's not just wetlands. I don't know if you can perhaps expand on that and its relationship to the mining work that you were discussing.
Well, generally, for the exploration piece, you're probably more in wetlands or in wetlands areas, setting up drill rigs, doing soil sampling, then you would be discharging to streams. And so I think that's why we said what we did about that. But they are correct that discharges of dredged or filled material into waters of the U.S., which includes streams and wetlands and a bunch of other things, do require 404 permits.
Can you talk a little bit about how cultural or archaeological matters are resolved during the exploration phase?
Well, I would say just like during development of a mine, there would need to be a cultural resource clearance done if there was the potential for historic properties or cultural resources in that area. If the project is on federal land and the company that's doing the exploration would have to work with the Federal Land Management Agency, BLM, or the Forest Service, who in turn might have to do consultation under the National Historic Preservation Act on any properties that are within the area of impact. Mitigation might need to occur. I think that the part three, or maybe it's part three of this webinar series that gets into sort of the regulatory process, is going to talk about the National Historic Preservation Act and how it's applied on mining sites, and the same, it would also be applied similarly on exploration sites, even though the area of influence, is probably smaller for exploration versus mining.
Okay. And states have similar historic preservation for facilities that might be located on state land. So
yeah,
there'd be a...
We may not have consultation, but...
Yeah, but there'd be some sort of process there, too.
Right, and we have a couple of participants who are chiming in that that's in line, that in their experience, there are cultural resource clearances that are done in conjunction with state historic preservation agencies. And so they have to adhere to the NHPA and Section 106, in addition to the ARPA and a number of other archaeological regulations. So it sounds like you guys are right in line with that answer. I'm going to take two more comments or questions from the audience here. And one of the attendees wants to know if there are other examples of land exchanges that are done, for example, government exchanges to private owners. Are there any other examples of land exchanges that you can think of?
I can't think of any off the top of my head, but I know that there have been some proposals in not necessarily mining, but other venues like timber sales, where the government owns certain lands and there's a process for exchanging them with another party to facilitate timber processing, and I think that there's a similar process for mining, but I can't think of any that have occurred that I know of.
Okay, I think I do have a few participants who are chiming in here.
That
in a few states where this does happen, certain state BLMs do these types of land exchanges. For example, in Utah and Arizona, they're mentioning. But they said it's not necessarily mining related, but those types of land exchanges do take place. All right, so I'm going to read off this last question, and then we'll go ahead and carry on with the presentation. But, of course, participants, keep those comments and questions coming in. I think the instructors would agree with me that you're sharing some really great relevant experience and comments and questions for them, so keep that up. Let's take this last question here before we resume with the talks. One of the attendees mentions that in Arizona there are over 700 mining claims that are either in or near the Grand Canyon. But there's also a 20-year ban on uranium mining by the Department of Interior. They are just wondering if the government could possibly buy back some of those mining claims if they find that mining near the Grand Canyon could be dangerous to the Colorado River or to the canyon ecosystem itself.
Well, anything's possible. And I think that is something similar happened around Yellowstone maybe, 15, 20 mm-hmm. years ago with New World Mine.
Yeah.
That there was a buyback of the claims. And so I don't think that there's anything more recent than that, or at least not to the same extent as it was then. But it definitely is a possibility.
Okay. On federal land.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm sure that...
I guess the state could do the same.
I guess it could be done state or tribe or whatever.
Okay. All right, excellent. Well, I think in the interest of time, we'll go ahead and carry on with the next segment of the presentation today. And I believe, Cindy, you're going to take over again, correct?
I am. Yeah. We lost our transition slide somewhere in here. So Lorraine talked about exploration, and I'm going to talk about mining. So a mine is a hole in the ground that a company pours money into, hoping money starts coming out at an acceptable rate of return. Or, as it says here, it's a location where rocks containing valuable minerals are extracted from the ground. And a rock becomes a rock containing valuable minerals is called ore, and a rock becomes ore when the mineral content is economically feasible to mine. So the grade, or how much metal is in each ton of ore in grams, ounces, or tons, or pounds, depending on the metal, and the commodity price, the dollars per ounce or pound, are important decisions in the process of what gets mined and what gets left behind. So smaller mines can produce at the rates of hundreds to thousands of tons per day, while larger mines can produce in the hundreds of thousands of tons per day. And there's no specific rhyme or reason to this list of the types of mining, but open pit and strip mining are generally larger than underground mines, which are generally larger than placer mines. And when we talked about uranium in the first section, I mentioned in situ mining. And this process involves pumping a solution underground into the ore body to dissolve the minerals. The solution is then returned to the surface to extract the metal. The ore body must be permeable enough for the solution to pass through, and care has to be taken not to contaminate groundwater. So in open pit mining, ore is accessed from the surface. The overburden is removed, and the material is blasted.
Okay, and at this point, we're going to call up a video to demonstrate that blast process. So participants, check your volume settings, and let's hit play.
Fire in the hole.
Whoa.
And the material is then hauled to the crusher, which starts the milling process. So the blast that you just saw occurred at the Fort Knox mine near Fairbanks, Alaska, where gold is mined. You can see the open pit here where the blast occurred. The milling facilities are up here in the top left corner. And the tailings impoundment is here where the waste product, tailings from the milling process are ultimately stored. And Fort Knox, the ultimate product at Fort Knox is gold bars. So this is kind of a busy slide that shows accessing different types of underground ore bodies. And vertical or inclined shafts can be used to access ore bodies, which could be massive, as shown here, or a sloping vein, as is shown here. And it also depicts how a mine life can be extended by discovering new ore that hasn't been found before. So the mine life would be extended by finding this undiscovered ore. This is a picture of the Greens Creek mine in southeast Alaska near Juneau. They mine silver, lead, and zinc here. It started out to be a lead zinc mine, but the grade of silver ended up being higher, so now they call it a silver mine. And in the previous slide, it talked about there being an adit access, but an adit really wasn't shown on there because, as you can see here, an adit is a tunnel that goes straight into the side of a mountain to access the ore body. This is an example of strip mining. It's Yusa Belly Coal Mine in interior Alaska. And one of the advantages of strip mining is that you could be mining a strip while previously mined strips are in various stages of concurrent reclamation. And here's another example of strip mines showing phosphate mines in southeast Idaho. So a placer deposit refers to a metal, usually gold, although it could apply to other heavy metals such as platinum, that is deposited in its native form. And this means that it's just gold or just platinum, and it's not bound up with other mineralization. So gravity separation is used because the metal is heavier than the surrounding material. And so this slide shows a mechanical dredge, which is operating in a pond system off of a stream channel. And this shows a suction dredge, which is operating within an active stream channel in Oregon. So, Jean, before I turn it over to Patty, are there any questions?
There are. We had one participant which would like to know, what is a placer mine?
Well, a placer mine is an area where placer deposits are found. So you'd find gold in its native form. So you might find nuggets or flakes of gold. Generally, you'll find them in old stream channels. So when a stream channel meanders, you know, you might find it on a stream bank or up on the hill above a stream channel, or even within a stream channel. And those are generally accessed through some type of panning, hand sluicing, or suction dredging.
Okay. And then we just had one of the organizers just mention that this is in comparison to a vein of ore.
Right. And veins are usually, when we talk about ore having or rock having a mineral content, it's generally not just gold or just platinum. It's a conglomeration of different minerals which contain the gold and contain the platinum. And so in placer, you're looking at the material which is in its free form.
We did have somebody ask, and this is going to go back a little bit, about, I'm trying to think of, we have a number of questions that are coming in regarding permitting requirements. So if this is something that will be highlighted in the future webinar series, by all means, just let me know. But this person, they want to know if you could please describe the EPA permits that are needed for solution or in-situ mines.
I've never worked with one, but Patty?
Ebony in our region.
Well, there's probably a lot of permits, but the one that's unique to in-situ mining would be underground injection control permits. And I can't quite recall if it's a class 5 or what class.
No, it's a class
3 or 4 underground injection control permits. So these are permits that would need to be applied for, would need to describe how the chemicals that are being injected to leach the uranium or copper or whatever is subject to in-situ leaching. It would have to describe those chemicals, the amount that's being injected, whether or not there's aquifers in the area that could be impacted, the type of monitoring that would occur, the type of closure that would occur. So that's just one of the permits that would be needed that is unique to that process. There would be the other kind of standard permits that would also be required related to land use and water use if that's needed.
Right, and that's not a permit that we really talk about in the third module, the underground injection control. So that is a unique question.
Maybe there's time to add it.
Yeah.
Well, so related to that, we did have a few people chime in that the in-situ, the ISU minings are considered Class 3 UIC wells. And we did have somebody mention that uranium in-situ mining also requires permitting by the NRC in addition to state permitting requirements. But one of the instructors for Part 3 of the webinar series is listening. And she heard that question, and she mentioned that they can try to incorporate more of that information into the Part 3 of the webinar series. So thank you to everybody who contributed and shared some information and shared some thoughts on that comment. I'm going to go back to another question here that I have about block cave underground mining. This participant mentions that they understand the Resolution Copper underground mine proposed this type. Can you comment on this technique? Again, it's block cave underground mining.
So in block caving, the underground area is, you know, the ore is extracted, and the material over that area collapses in on itself. And so there could be, depending on the depth of the ore body, there could be a lot of subsidence at the surface or a little subsidence at the surface. But I'm not sure what more I can say about it.
Okay. All right. We did have a number of people respond really positively to that video of the explosion or the blast at the mine site, so they appreciated that. And just in I'm going to share a comment that somebody typed in, and they said that a mining engineer once told me that the definition of a mine is really just a waste treatment facility with a little bit of gold, copper, et cetera, at the end of it. And I don't know if you have any thoughts on that particular definition or concept of what a mine is.
That's a good segue into this.
Yeah. Patty says it's a good segue into mineral processing, but I might add that to my definition of it being just a hole in the ground, too.
All right, excellent. So again, participants, you can continue to share those comments and questions. If we have other ones that come in on these earlier topics, we will return back to them. We do have time available at the end of the session today. But let's carry on with the next segment of today's talk. And I believe we have Patty who's going to step up next. Is that correct?
Yes. So I hope everyone can hear me. I'm probably the most soft-spoken of the three of us in the room here. So I'm going to talk about mineral processing, and mineral processing is really simply the steps that are involved in extracting the valuable mineral or metal from the ore. So this picture shows a sample of ore from the Pogo gold mine in Alaska, and you can't really see the gold in it, that's pyrite, but there are small amounts of gold in there. In order to extract the gold, a number of steps have to take place. Depending on the type of ore, there might be more than one valuable metal that is recovered. So this schematic shows kind of an example of a copper mine that that would produce both copper and gold following mineral processing steps. The leftover waste material after mineral processing is called tailings, and tailings are disposed of usually quite near the mine site. I think the discussion of tailings will get into more detail in part two in the environmental concerns section, which is on May 24th, the webinar on May 24th. The metal or mineral that is being extracted as part of the mineral processing process is referred to as the target metal, so if you hear me use that term, that's what I'm referring to. And the types of mineral processing techniques are used really depends on the concentrations of that metal in the ore and the technical and economic feasibility of extracting them from the ore. So there's three main steps that occur in the mineral processing process that I'll talk about in more detail in the following slides. This is a list of many of the common steps that are used. The first step is to crush and grind the rock to break it up and release the valuable mineral. The second step usually entails concentration of that mineral or metal, and the third step is purifying it to produce pure metal. And there's different kinds of processing techniques that are used. A few of the commonly used techniques are the ones listed on this slide, and I'll focus on each one of these steps in the subsequent slides. There's a whole lot of techniques that I'm not going to talk about, like magnetic separation. I'm not going to go into detail on gravity separation. I'm not going to talk too much about hydrometallurgical processes other than leaching, just mainly due to time constraints. Another thing I just want to mention here is when you hear the term mineral processing, you also sometimes hear it called beneficiation or extractive metallurgy, or the old timers refer to it as milling or just simply processing. So when you hear those terms, they're all kind of talking about the same thing, and that's the steps of removing the valuable mineral or metals from the ore. So I'm going to grab the pointer here. So in mineral processing, a couple of things happen. First, you have a step that will concentrate your valuable mineral or metal. So for example, you might start with an ore that has 2% copper. The copper is actually bound in a mineral form, such as chalcopyrite, which is a copper iron sulfide mineral. The first stage of processing is just to simply concentrate that copper sulfide mineral so that instead of being 2%, it's 30%. Then the subsequent processing steps that occur involve breaking apart the copper iron sulfide mineral bond so that you end up with pure copper. And everything else, the iron, the sulfide minerals, and the other waste minerals are tailings that are disposed of at or near the mine site. So this first step, and one other thing I want to mention, maybe let me go back a slide, is so this is just sort of an example of mineral processing steps, real basic steps for converting chalcopyrite to copper. If copper was contained in another mineral form, such as a copper carbonate, then you would use very different processing techniques. You would probably use a leaching technique. So the first step of mineral processing is crushing and grinding. And crushing and grinding is necessary in order to reduce the particle size of your ore material in order to expose the surface of the valuable mineral that you're trying to extract. Crushing occurs dry. Often a crusher is located next to the mine area. Grinding occurs wet, so water is added at the grinding stage. There's a whole lot of different kinds of equipment that's used for crushing and grinding. Crushers, you often hear about jaw crushers or cone crushers. Grinding occurs in mills like the mills shown here, where steel balls or steel rods are used to break up the rock as the mill goes round and round. And Gene, if you could show the video that we have of a ball mill. So this shows a ball mill in action, turning round and round. If you were standing next to it, it'd be quite loud and you would need hearing protection for sure to be in that area. Sometimes these mills, this is probably a medium-sized mill. Sometimes you would have a much larger mill, and often you'd have more than one of these in a mineral processing facility. So at the end of the crushing and grinding step, you've gone from big rocks to very small-sized particles. The particles might be as fine as sand, or they could be even as fine as powder, depending on what is needed for the subsequent processing step. So one common mineral processing step that's used at a lot of mining operations is called flotation. And flotation is a process that's used to physically separate out the valuable mineral from the rest of the minerals. The flotation process occurs in a tank, or a flotation cell is what it's called, where water and chemicals are added to facilitate the flotation process. The kind of chemicals that are added really depends upon the target mineral that you're trying to collect and the other minerals that you're trying not to collect. Examples of the types of chemicals that are added are shown on this slide. Organic compounds are used to promote the flotation process. Small amounts of cyanide might be used. Copper sulfate, zinc, sulfate, oils, alcohols, and limes and acids. So this next slide shows a picture of a flotation cell here, and how the flotation process works is air is basically injected into the cell or tank. Chemicals are added that stick to the surface of the target minerals. Those chemicals make the target minerals want to stick to the bubbles of air that are within this slurry of ground ore material. As those minerals stick to bubbles, the bubbles rise up to the top along with the target mineral. Separate chemicals are added called frothers that make the air bubbles strong and resilient so that they'll actually collect on the surface of the flotation cell. And as the flotation process commences, the flotation concentrate on the top overflows and is collected. So this shows that this picture is the picture taken at the Thompson Creek mine where molybdenum is processed. And here's a picture of the flotation cell in action with a molybdenite flotation concentrate that's overflowing and will be collected and further processed. Sorry, I'm having problems with advancing. Okay. Another kind of mineral processing that's commonly occurred is called leaching. Leaching is different than flotation. In flotation, you have a sort of physical separation occurs where the valuable mineral is physically separated out from the target mineral or from the rest of the waste minerals. In leaching, the target metal is actually dissolved away from the rest of the ore. And leaching can be done either on ore that's been ground, or it can be on a flotation concentrate. So it can be a first stage or a second stage of mineral processing. Leaching is used for various metal ores. The type of chemicals that are used in the leaching process depends upon the metal that is being extracted. For example, cyanide is used to selectively dissolve gold and silver from ores or concentrates. Sulfuric acid is commonly used to dissolve copper in copper leaching. And both acids and bases, such as sodium carbonate, are used to leach uranium from uranium ores. Leaching can occur in vats or in tanks, as shown on this slide. Often more than one tank is used. At the end of the leaching process, you have a solution that contains the dissolved metal, and might be kind of hard to see, but this solution is sometimes called the pregnant solution because it's full of metal. So if you ever hear that term, that's what's meant. The pregnant solution needs further processing in order to produce a solid metal from the dissolved metal, and I'll talk about those steps in some of the next slides. After the metal is removed from that pregnant solution, the solution is reused in the process. It's often called barren solution at that stage. Here's the barren solution that's going to actually be reused back into the leaching operation. Following the leaching process, you have a solid slurry of materials from which the gold or copper or whatever your target mineral is has been removed for the most part, and the leftover slurry material is also called tailings that need to be disposed of. The type of disposal for those tailings really depends on the type of leaching. If you have cyanide leaching that's occurred, then the tailings need to be detoxified before they're disposed. If you've used acid leaching, then the tailings need to be neutralized. And I believe the May 24th webinar on the environmental concerns of mining is going to discuss detoxification in more detail. So another form of leaching is called heap leaching. Heap leaching is different than bat leaching because it occurs in the environment. In heap leaching, you have ore that might come directly from the mine or might have been crushed in ground first, and that ore is placed on top of a liner in a heap. It's usually layered underneath or above the liner. There's a drainage system. Your leaching solution is sprinkled on top of the heap. As it percolates through the ore material, the dissolved metal is collected on the liner and flows into a pond. The solution in the pond then is subject to subsequent processing steps. So this slide shows a picture of a cyanide heap leach that's used to recover gold. Other heap leaching operations are used for copper and also for uranium. Similar to tailings from a vat or a tank leach, this heap would need to be rinsed and detoxified before it's closed. At the end of the leaching process, you have dissolved metals that are in solution. So the next processing steps involve recovering the metal out of that solution. And there's a number of ways to do it. The three most common are shown on this slide. First is carbon absorption that is used in gold and silver cyanidation. So in carbon, during the carbon absorption process, the gold that's in the cyanide solution is absorbed onto carbon. And that carbon needs to be further treated in order to extract the gold from it. And often that further treatment involves a high concentration leach followed by electrowinning. And the electrowinning process is a process that uses basically electro-refining to extract metals out of solution by plating the metal onto a cathode. The picture shown in this slide is actually of an electrowinning process. The cathodes are being kind of pulled out of the electrowinning circuit, and they have coated on them the valuable metal, and I believe in this example it's copper. Another process that's used to separate metal from solution is called precipitation, and in this process chemicals are added to the solution that has the dissolved metals in order to form a metal precipitate that would sink to the bottom of your precipitation cell. And that metal precipitate then has a higher concentration of metal, but still requires further processing in order to produce pure metal. Okay. The final stage of processing is to purify the metal. And this occurs at high temperatures in furnaces in order to produce a molten metal. So into the furnace, you might have added your sludge from precipitation or your scrapings from electrowinning cathodes. And you also add into the refining furnace other chemicals that bind with the waste minerals that you are trying to remove. And these chemicals, when mixed in the refining furnace, form a slag on top of the molten metal so that that slag can be actually poured off the top. And the molten metal can be poured also separately from the slag into either bars, rods, plates, or other forms. At this point, the metal is like 99.99% pure, and it can be sold to companies that use these metal materials to make all the products that we use in everyday life. In the next two slides, I'm going to show you an example of how all these different mineral processing steps are sort of put together in order to form a flow sheet that kind of shows from start to finish how you go from an ore body to actually a metal product. And these are just examples. There are many other ways to combine these different techniques, but this is something that is fairly typical of gold processing. So in this example, you have gold that's being mined from an open pit ore body. During the mining process, waste rock has to be moved in order to access the ore, and the waste rock is disposed of usually in dumps near the mine site. The ore is removed from the ground. It goes to a crushing and grinding circuit to reduce the particle size. Then it goes into flotation circuit. Out of the flotation circuit, you end up with a flotation concentrate. You also end up with tailings, the leftover materials that are disposed in a tailings disposal facility. And again, the next webinar will discuss tailings management. Now, at this point, the flotation concentrate actually might be trucked away from the mine site, or it may stay at the mine and mineral processing site for further processing. So after the flotation concentrate is recovered, it's subject to cyanide leaching and then carbon absorption. The gold is now inside carbon, and that term is called loaded carbon. Your leach tailings are also sent to a tailings disposal facility. The loaded carbon is stripped, usually with hot acid solution. The carbon is regenerated and reused back in the processing. The stripping solution from carbon now contains the gold. That stripping solution is subject to electrowinning to plate the carbon, and then the gold is further refined to produce the gold product that is used to make whatever needs to be made from it. So this example, again, is just an example. A flow sheet for other gold processing facilities might include a roaster or an autoclave after flotation. That's common when you have sulfide ores in order to oxidize the concentrate to make leaching more efficient. There also might be subsequent stages of processing to collect any other valuable metals, such as silver, or if you had a copper molybdenum mine, you might see separate copper molybdenum products being produced. The other thing I want to say about this flow sheet is it shows a few of the waste streams associated with processing, the tailings from leaching, the tailings from flotation, but it doesn't show some of the other things that occur during processing, such as there's dust that is emitted during the crushing and grinding process. There's air emissions during carbon stripping. There's air emissions during carbon stripping, electrowinning, and refining that have to be subject to pollution control. And these are the kind of issues that will be discussed in the regulatory section of the webinar on May 24th. So I'm going to conclude the discussion of mineral processing with just pictures of a couple of facilities so that you see what they look like. The one on the top is the Red Dog Mine, located in Alaska. At Red Dog, at the Red Dog Mine, there are lead and zinc concentrates that are produced at the mine, flotation concentrates that are then trucked further away to a smelter for later processing. Red Dog processes ore at a rate of about 10,000 tons per day. The other picture I'm showing here is of part of the Bingham Canyon mine processing facilities. At Bingham Canyon, like Red Dog, flotation is used, but there's also subsequent processing that's used at the site, smelting and refining to produce copper. Gold, silver, and molybdenum are also produced at Bingham Canyon, and their processing rate is about more than 10 times larger than Red Dog, about 150,000 tons per day. So these are just sort of, this slide just kind of shows the difference in the level of sort of activity that might occur at a mine and mineral processing site. So that's all I have on mineral processing. As I said at the beginning, there's a whole lot of different techniques that are used, and they're put together in different ways depending on the mineral or the metal that you're trying to collect from the ore, and I'd be happy to answer questions that folks have about sort of other techniques that I didn't cover here.
All right. So again, for participants, you can continue to submit those comments or questions into the Q&A window that appears in the lower right corner of your screen. We do have a number of them that have already come in, and we'll continue to queue those up and try to get through as many as we can in the time that we have left. So one of our first questions that I want to bring up is, someone would like to know, what's the difference between a smelter and a mill?
Okay, so, you know, a mill can almost mean anything in a way. I mean, I've heard the term mill used to describe the entire processing facility at a mine site. You might say, you know, the ore goes to the mill, and out of the mill comes copper. So it can be a very general term that's used. If you're a metallurgist, the term mill usually means only the upfront part of processing, so the crushing and the grinding and flotation that occurs. A smelter is basically one unit process that occurs, and it's a furnace, basically a really high temperature furnace, where you would have a solid material like a flotation concentrate might get sent to a smelter, and out of the smelter you would end up with a solid product that has a solid metal that is more refined than what went into it. So, for example, you might have a copper flotation concentrate that's 30% copper go to a smelter, and out of the smelter you would have a copper product that is 90% copper or 95% copper.
All right, excellent. One attendee asked if you could touch on the need for some mines to have mercury abatement and controls in place.
Sure, and I can actually, it might be easier to actually go to this slide on gold processing, because it's really during gold ore processing where you have the highest tendency to have mercury emissions. So mercury is the kind of material that volatilizes, forms a gas at elevated temperatures. And because of that, you need to have special control equipment in order to collect the mercury. So standard control equipment that you might use for dust is really not enough to also control the mercury air emissions. And in this particular example of gold, you would have mercury air control equipment at the refinery, because the emissions from the refinery furnace would have volatilized mercury in them. You would also have mercury control equipment during electrowinning, and probably also during carbon stripping. If you had an ore roaster at any point in this process, you would also want to have mercury control equipment on the emissions from that roaster. And there's different kinds of mercury control equipment that can be used. There's some mercury control equipment that is most effective by using carbon absorption to absorb that mercury. Then the mercury might also be condensed. So there's different types of equipment that are used and have been used really successfully at gold operations, particularly in Nevada.
Can you clarify, is the mercury physically in the ore itself?
Yes. So the mercury actually starts out in the ore, so it's naturally present in the ore, and it moves through the process. And as it moves through the process, some of it is volatilized and needs to be controlled with the air equipment that I just described. Some of the mercury remains in the tailings and will end up in the tailings facility and needs to be controlled in the tailings facility.
Okay, and you highlighted or mentioned the roaster in this diagram. Could you just add or expand exactly on how the roaster works? And then I'm seeing a number of clarifying questions come in on mercury as well, so we may come back to the mercury concept after you talk about the roaster.
Yeah. So sometimes you have an ore or a flotation concentrate that's called refractory, and what that means is that it's if you would put that ore or concentrate directly into a leaching process, you might only recover, 50% of the gold out of it, which is not a sufficient recovery to make the process economical. So in order to make that ore or flotation concentrate more amenable to leaching, what you would do is you would roast it or pressure oxidize it in an autoclave. And what that does, it converts sulfide minerals into oxide minerals, and that makes the subsequent leaching steps much more effective. So you wouldn't see a roaster and autoclave at every processing facility. It would just really depend upon the kind of ore that you're using and the mineral that you're trying to collect.
Okay. A number of people have sort of sent in related questions or clarifying statements, and they're all talking, I think, about the same thing here, something that you just said. So I'm going to read through some of them, and maybe we'll just get one clarifying answer for all of it. One person wanted to know if mercury is sometimes brought into the process for leaching, not necessarily as part of the ore, but as part of that leaching process. And then other people have, again, asked if these mercury controls, if they're also being put into place if you don't have roasters or autoclaves.
So mercury isn't used anymore. I mean, in historical times, mercury actually used to be used to actually bind onto gold and silver in a process called amalgamation, but mercury is no longer actually physically used or added to the leaching process or any other mineral processing techniques anymore. It really results as a product of ore that naturally contains mercury, and it gets released during some of the mineral processing steps. And not every gold ore has mercury. Some gold ores do, some don't, and the concentrations are different. So it's a real sort of site-specific consideration. And what was the second question?
The other question was just clarifying if the mercury controls are being applied at sites that do not have a roaster or autoclave.
Yes, so you would have mercury controls would be applied basically wherever they're needed in order, to meet your Clean Air Act permit requirements. And so, for example, the project that I am working on right now, we would have mercury emission controls on an autoclave, but also on emissions from the refinery circuit, and also on emissions from the carbon regeneration and carbon stripping circuits. So anywhere that there's a gaseous stream that has mercury in it at a level that needs to be controlled.
Okay. We also have had a couple of other just comments coming in that mercury can be used, and this is just a general idea that you're talking about what happens here at the U.S. There are other practices in place in other countries and other mining facilities outside of the U.S. So although we may not use it here in the U.S. anymore, other mines may use it elsewhere in the world. Would you say that's correct?
I would say that's, I don't know in terms of large mining operations if that's correct, but I know definitely there are small placer miners that still use mercury.
Okay. Well, we're going to move on and ask another question, and this time is about the reclamation phase. Can you say anything more about this phase of the mining process and what kind of considerations might be out there for arid and other climates?
Well, I guess this is a good probably question for the May 24th webinar on environmental issues, or even the webinar after that talks about the regulatory process and, state reclamation and closure laws. But I think for a lot of modern mining companies, at the same time you're thinking about, the type of mining operation that you're going to do, the type of mineral processing, you're also thinking about what reclamation and closure is going to look like, in order to minimize environmental problems? And, you know, I guess it's just such a general question, it's kind of hard to answer because
reclamation
can be so specific.
Right.
To
and it depends on what the land manager or the landowner wants to be the final use for the land and how it's reclaimed and everything. So it's very site specific.
Okay. All right. We did have a participant who just chimed in with a comment about the pregnant ponds that you were talking about earlier. And this attendee simply said that the pregnant ponds can be, quote, within the heap and not necessarily exposed to air or the environment. And I don't know if you can expand on that thought, Patty.
Yeah, that's correct. You know, a lot of these processes have variations. You know, I think the discussion was pretty general. But there are definitely variations in this, how the leaching processes are set up and conducted, and you might not have an actual pond of pregnant solution or barren solution. That solution might be collected immediately after it is drained out of the heap and then sent to further processing. So you wouldn't necessarily have to have a pond.
Okay. I'm going to ask a question that you on a topic earlier, and then I have another one that I've got in my queue here. But one attendee mentioned that water added during grinding primarily as – let me step back and repeat this question in the correct way. They're asking you if water is added during grinding primarily as a means to minimize dust or is it to minimize heat?
It's actually more used to make the grinding process more efficient. You know, the answer would be to minimize heat to make the grinding more efficient. And sometimes the chemicals that are going to be used in flotation are actually added to the grinding circuit so that you get them well mixed. And you need to add water to sort of also help that mixture.
Okay. One of our attendees wants to know if you can explain the TRI and the high numbers associated with mining. Do tribes have involvement with this?
Well, you've caught us at a loss for words. The toxics release inventory is basically a report of movement of material at mine sites, along with other industrial categories that are included. But because of the large quantities of material that mines disturb and also move, the generally higher numbers are at mine sites, and so. You know, the reports of what the materials are come from the mining companies themselves, and so there's not a tribal input on what what those numbers are, and how different entities react to different numbers. I'm not sure. But because mining does move a lot of material, and the material is considered, because of the levels of metals in it, are considered toxic in some ways, it doesn't necessarily mean that those products have been released in the environment. I mean, moving the rock from the mine to the mill is a movement of material, and moving it. Moving the tailings and moving the waste rock material from one site to another. And so you could have multiple moves of material that gets added up and is encountered in the TRI.
Okay. This is another question that may go back to you, Cindy. I'm going to start to open it up to some of the other outstanding comments and questions we had come in earlier. They'd like to know if you could differentiate between block caving from block and pillar or other types of underground mining that exist.
Okay, so we've talked about block caving in that you extract the ore and allow the basically the roof to cave in on the opening that you've made. In room and pillar mining, you leave pillars to support the roof, and basically you mine in a grid pattern. A mine that I worked at in Kentucky, we had 45-foot pillars and 30-foot openings that we mined mined limestone in that pattern. And so it was a square pattern, and we had a pillar, every 30 feet to support the roof so we could expand the area of the mine. And there is a process called robbing pillars, where if you get out to the furthest extent of the mine area that you're going to go to, you can come back, kind of as an exit strategy. You can rob material from the pillars as you go, and it could cause the roof to collapse in on itself too. But as long as you're doing the mining, that's not good for you to have happen. There's other methods of mining, stoping and some of the drift mining, like we saw in the slide, that very busy slide where the ore was accessed from the side of it, either the massive or the vein. And so there's different methods that are used to extract those materials.
All right, excellent. We had a participant, they want to know if you have any examples of offshore mining.
I don't.
Okay.
I mean, I've heard about mining the manganese. Manganese nodules on the ocean floor for years and years, but I don't know if it's economically feasible or possible currently.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard of offshore placer mining for gold.
That's about the only thing, but they aren't very far offshore.
one of these questions that keeps coming up about bulk caving and underground mining, and we didn't really touch on, is sometimes these tailings are actually used to backfill underground mines. They're mixed with concrete, and they're pumped back into the underground mine, the portions of the mine that are no longer being mined. And it's both a method of tailings disposal and also of enhancing the structural stability of the underground mine for folks that are working at different levels in the operation. So that's something that can occur in underground mining, except you can't use that in block cave mining.
Okay, and then I think some of where this question is coming from is there are other questions coming in related to oil and gas development, and they want to know if those things are related to mining or are those things considered separately because they have some sort of other industry classification.
I'm not sure I understood that comment, Jean.
So the participant says specifically, aside from coal mining, how are oil and gas development related to mining activities? Are they considered separately just due to industry classification conventions, or are they related to mining as you're discussing today?
Well, it's an extraction of a natural resource, but that's pretty much where the comparison would end.
Okay. Okay, excellent. Thank you. I have a few other comments and questions in here that I think we have time to get through today. So this next question, you talked about this a bit, but I want to circle back to this concept of protection. One of the participants wants to know what sort of protections exist to protect wildlife at leaching areas or tailing areas, or is this a topic that you'll cover in the second module?
It will likely be talked about. I don't know in how much detail in the future presentations, but there's a variety of different ways that companies use to protect wildlife from these areas, and you know, from fencing to you know, just physical activity that discourages wildlife from being there. You know, in netting off areas from birds. So there's a variety of things that people use.
Okay. All right. I have a very lengthy question. I'm going to read this question out loud, but bear with me. If I need to repeat the whole thing, let me know. One of the participants states that since the value of gold has increased to record levels, we have observed a pronounced increase in small-scale and informal placer gold mining activities. And these have had some very significant impacts to the integrity of river resources. Some states have responded to this by banning suction dredging in rivers. Some still allow it, but the impacts and issues stemming from it have sort of prompted new regulations to regulate and oversee this type of activity. And they're just curious if EPA is imposing regulations on placer gold mining operations, that they had previously looked at the Euchre placer mining for leads on the best management practices. Do you have any suggestions or resources that they could turn to for these best management practices for placer gold mining?
Well, EPA started, placer gold way back when. Now, in-stream suction dredging type mining, our first permits that we issued here in Region 10 were in Alaska in the early to mid-90s. And those permits contain BMPs that are meant to maintain the integrity of the stream channel and the flow in the stream. Now, that permit, it was issued in conjunction with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game permit, which has timing restrictions based on the presence of fish or in the stream or fish eggs in the gravels. And so that system together has worked well there, but in Alaska there's very few impaired waters and no critical habitat for endangered species. And so it's been a relatively easy regulatory scheme in Alaska. When we issued our suction dredge permit in Idaho a few years ago, the permit doesn't cover facilities in waters impaired for sediment or mercury, and not in critical habitat unless a consultation is done under the Endangered Species Act, either by EPA, which we don't regularly do, or by another federal agency that might have to permit the same activity. And so we had a lot of areas that miners were used to going to, and all of a sudden we said, no, you can't go there anymore. And we've had protests in Idaho the last 2 years. We're expecting another one this year, and it's been a really tough project to be affiliated with, because the state has their permitting scheme, and they will permit, it's kind of funny. The state is the entity that decides which water bodies are impaired for sediment and mercury, and they're the ones that even asked us to not include mercury impaired waters in coverage of the NPDES permit. But another state agency that issues the permits for suction dredging don't seem to have any connection with those water bodies that are impaired. And while they do cover things like state protected or wild and scenic rivers and things like that, they don't seem to have a full connection with the water quality piece of it. And so there's been a lot of discrepancies between what we'll cover and what the state will cover, which just leads to a lot of confusion.
Okay, excellent. I'm going to go back to a comment that came in earlier and our discussion about cultural studies. One attendee said that they think cultural studies, especially TCP studies, would be an important factor when determining where to issue permits during the exploration phase. And they just went on to ask, how often are these addressed?
I don't think we can answer how often this work is done, but you know, any diligent mining company would go into an area and understand that the potential for cultural resources or traditional cultural properties, which are what TCPs refer to, needs to be understood, and would do the kind of work that's necessary, whether it is looking at historical information that may be available publicly available reports or information from the State Historic Preservation Office, talking to tribes that are currently or historically using the area, doing surveys, either surveys in terms of talking to people like ethnographic studies or actually doing ground surveys. I think a company would go in and really determine based on knowledge of the area, talking to people, talking to the agencies, what more work needs to be done.
Okay. Well, I think in the interest of time, we'll probably go ahead and close out our Q&A period here. But while we have this slide up on the screen, again, do you guys want to provide some reminders to the attendees about the continuing webinar series and the future parts that are coming up?
Okay, so we've got the next session, Mining and Environmental Concerns and Issues, on May 24th at the same time frame. And on June 8th, the last part in the series, the regulatory process and how tribes, or basically anyone, can engage in the process, in the permitting and regulatory process.
All right, excellent. I do have a number of reminder items for the participants. You've sent in some questions to me about accessing the slides or the speaker contact information, or how to share feedback or get credit. So we'll talk through all of those reminders in just a moment. But before we do that, I wanted to give our presenters an opportunity to leave the audience with any final statements. So Patty, since you just spoke, I'll turn to you first. Any final thoughts you'd like to leave the audience with?
No, I guess I would just like to encourage folks to sign on and register for the next two webinars, because I think this information is really most effective when you can also hear the part two about the environmental concerns and the things that can be done to alleviate concerns and issues, and then also the regulatory process that overlies everything and how folks can be involved and engaged. And I also just want to thank EPA for inviting me to present and participate in this webinar.
Excellent. Thank you. Lorraine, any final thoughts for the audience?
No, not for me.
Okay. And Cindy, any closing thoughts?
Well, Lorraine actually has one that she's expressed to me a couple times, and I'll just voice it here. And I think that Lorraine's reminder during the presentation that not all exploration projects become mines. It's a slim process, and so that is good to know that if there's something going on in the area, you can find out about it, but it's not always going to be go past the exploration phase.
And you have a lot of time to get involved.
Yeah, and at that point, you do have a lot of time to get involved and learn about it and participate in any processes going forward.
All right, excellent. Well, with that, let me go ahead and walk through some of those final reminders for today's session. The live audience that participated during today's broadcast, we had a wonderful turnout with attendees from actually all over the U.S., with a handful of international participants. I want to thank our organizers from EPA Region 10 who helped pull together today's session, as well as the instructors who were able to join us, Cindy Godsey, Lorraine Edmond, and Patty McGrath. Just a few final reminders. As mentioned, we are testing out a certificate that you can obtain after you submit feedback for one of our webinars. We oftentimes get requests for these certificates for participants who are trying to earn CEUs or PDHs. We don't necessarily issue the CEUs or PDHs. However, we understand that many of you still apply to earn credit through your various accrediting institutions, and certificates are helpful as part of that process. So if you would like to obtain one of these certificates, it will at least verify that you participated in the webinar. You'll need to submit feedback for today's event. We shared the feedback URL earlier, but you'll also find it under the related URLs window on the middle right of your screen. Simply fill out that online feedback form, and at the bottom of that form, there's a box that you can check that will confirm or verify that you participated for the whole session. If you check that box, there will be a certificate generated immediately for you to view, print, or save, and we'll also email that same thing to you. If you don't check that box, you have not verified that you participated, and we will not generate a certificate for you. So we are testing this tool out. We do welcome your comments and your thoughts on it. This is just a screenshot of what the certificate looks like, an email that you'll receive. So I really do welcome you to test this tool out. You can share your feedback any point from today forward. So if you happen to be one of the lucky people replaying the recorded version of this webinar, you can still follow the link to the seminar feedback form and share your thoughts. If you participated in a group, each person can fill out their own copy of the feedback form to get their own certificate. And I welcome your thoughts on this process. As noted, we do have copies of the presentation materials as well as a few other related resources. One participant actually chimed in and shared the EIS for the Resolution Copper Mine Project, so we've included a hyperlink to that EIS. You'll find it under related URLs. We also have copies of the presentation materials, and we are making the correction to include that one missing section slide that wasn't in there earlier. So again, those updated slides will be posted and available for download as a resource. If you're looking for presenter information, you'll find it off of the seminar homepage. There's a tab for speakers, and you can read more about our instructors and their background. So as I said, please take a moment to fill out the online feedback form for today's session. And thank you so very much for joining us. We will carry on with the webinar, as mentioned, with seminar parts 2 and 3. Later on, we're going to do part 2 this month on May 24th, and then part 3 will take place in June. So I encourage you, if you haven't done so already, please sign up for the remaining webinars in the series. We will send an automatic email as soon as the recorded version is available from today's session, and I encourage you to share that with others that you think will find this to be a valuable expenditure of your time. Thank you so very much for joining us for today's live broadcast. This will be the formal conclusion for today's session.